Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, although I missed y'all last week.
I know. Where were you?
I was in Kansas.
Oh, right. Your family affair.
Yes. My grandmother's 103.
How'd that go?
It was great. It was great. It's great to see everybody, and I had a really nice time. Great weather.
How many candles did you guys do? What do you do when someone's over 100?
You get the 1, the 0, and the 3. That's what you do.
Good strategy.
It was wonderful, but thank you. And y'all did a great job last week. I enjoyed listening to the show. We have a great lineup of guests this morning, Lee. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, you want to listen up because we've got some great advice and some folks that are going to talk to you a little bit about your business. And then also, if you're in sales, great show to listen to if you have something to sell. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, first up this morning, we have Richard Brock, and I've been told that he literally pioneered the Salesforce automation industry in 1984 when he founded Brock Control Systems, which we now know as First Wave. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Richard.
Thank you very much.
So I understand that you were named as one of the 10 most influential people in CRM. Tell us what that means.
Well, I was early into it. I got into it, I guess, because I didn't have any sales training, so I didn't know that CRM wouldn't work. So I was a pioneer because I didn't know better. And having been there, and we did build the biggest company in the industry and the first one to go public in the CRM space originally, and that's how we got the recognition.
Can you talk about like what that means and how you came up with the concept?
Well, the interesting thing is because my degree is in accounting and I have CPA and MBA, but I didn't have any sales training. So I thought you should have it used. I did like computers, and you should use them to track the sales process so that you can get a better return on your marketing dollars. So not knowing that salesmen wouldn't use something like that, I developed a system and found that they would use it if it was properly written and supported and sold to them, et cetera. So I was a pioneer because I didn't know better.
But now, what was the pain that the salesperson was having that your system solved?
Well, the pain constantly changes as technology and assets, business models. They can have technology. We have the business cards, if you will, the little 3x5 index cards, which is what people used to keep their transactions on. And the problem was the salesmen couldn't actually organize that properly. So the first computer systems we did organized the information for the salesman and captured the information and helped them prioritize their follow-ups and make sure that the follow-ups did happen. And now, of course, the internet has broken the sales cycle, so we've shifted more towards the marketing automation to help the salesperson because their role has changed dramatically in the sales.
So you have an entrepreneurial history. Can you walk us through that? Where'd you start?
I guess my first job, I think I was like 7. I was selling an apple to a guy on the other side of the schoolyard. But then I had a job at 11 working in a grocery store. But the first entrepreneurial things were after working for Price Waterhouse, I joined a large local CPA firm. But then I spun off and started a computer service bureau. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun. And I was doing work for other CPAs and other clients. So then I started selling software to other CPAs. And so along the way, that morphed into I sold that business. But because people recognized I had automated the sales process at that software company selling software to CPAs, it amazed me that that was amazing. And so then I came up with the idea, well, CRM would be a good thing. Of course, it wouldn't call in the back. It's called Salesforce Automation back then. And so everybody said it wouldn't work, but I thought it might. And so that's why I got into it. I was actually the first person that really got it going.
What types of companies are using your software?
All over the place. We have some large ones, some big ones. We have Bearing Point is one that people would know, a big consulting firm out of New York. We've got 8 of their divisions now using it for marketing automation. Mm-hmm. We have Salesforce. I mean, we integrate with Salesforce.com. A lot of our customers have that, but for their sales application, but others don't. Red Prairie is a big company. Manhattan Associates is using it for customer support. So it depends on the company. We've got a project with Federal Express. But the sweet spot, we believe, is the middle market companies. And because there's so many of them, mm-hmm. and because if you offer software as a service, it's there's no entry point. And right now we're focusing on the marketing market, marketing automation. We have a new company called LeadLife.com that focuses on the marketing department, recognizing that their problem is they can't get good support from the IT department. They don't have large budgets, so you rent the software to them. Software as a service really makes it easy to get an entree and solve a really high problem, high perceived need problem.
Interesting. So all of this can be customized, or is it kind of, you know, a one package deal?
Well, that's where we gain a real competitive advantage is because marketing is, if you go in any retail mall or whatever, all the stores are similar, basically, and they have to differentiate. So one size does not fit all in marketing.
Right.
So that's one of our strengths is customizations, because and we help them do that, because the marketing people know what they need, but they don't get the internal support often to do it. So we're an outsourced assistant to them on best practices from how others are doing what they need. Like on lead scoring is a big area right now. That's because the internet has broken the sales cycle, where the sales rep used to be the broker of information, mm-hmm. and to the customer, so he knew what he sent and et cetera. Well, what we do is now 80% of the business purchases are initiated over the internet. And so what we do is we capture that behavior and score the buyer's behavior, capture what they downloaded, et cetera, and then work with the company to put a scoring mechanism so that the volume of leads that are given to the sales reps are color-coded between the red hot leads, the green leads, the gray leads. And then we do nurturing so that those people who came to the website and downloaded something get more information about that which we were interested in. So when they're finally willing to talk to a salesperson, because they no longer have to. That's the trick. They no longer have to. They can make purchases without ever talking to a salesperson.
Right.
So that's what we do, is focusing on that area because it's a new pioneering area.
It sounds like you're almost kind of transforming how they do sales. Like, this system really holds our hand through the whole process.
Lee, I think the answer would be that we didn't do that. The market did that. The internet did that, because it broke the brokering relationship. So the sales reps don't get to talk to the salespeople, the buyers, if you will, to weigh down the sales cycle. So it puts a lot of pressure on the internet marketing. Well, the problem is the old joke about on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Well, if you don't have the right behavior tracking on your website and the right tracking programs and scoring mechanisms, you will not know whether it's a dog or a person.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get the volume of hits, and there's no way to, unless you use digital behavior, to know who's qualified and who's not. So we're solving a problem that that exists, and they're going to have to solve it properly or poorly. That's their choice. So thankfully, it's a high perceived need. When people see this, it goes, yeah, I got that problem.
Sure.
So it's the best time.
Right. And so how have you seen the internet change the way people buy? You said people can buy without actually seeing someone or speaking with someone. Where have you seen that? What's been the biggest change?
Well, it's interesting, because when it first came out, people thought it would displace the retail channel, and it hasn't. But what it's done, it's displaced, let's say, the print advertising and whatever, because we all know that Google search and things like that is how we initiate business purchases.
Mm-hmm.
So what it's done is people will then go to a website, and they better be able to download the product information.
Right.
So they're going to look at all the competitors. In the past, they'd go to a trade show, and he who had the biggest mm-hmm. booth got the most information.
Right.
Well, now there's not a really huge advantage anymore to being a large company, and maybe a disadvantage, because with internet marketing, search engine optimizations, smaller companies can be retrieved on that search. So now the problem is you have to have a compelling offer so that they want to come back and talk to you. So they're not necessarily going to buy, but they're going to do all the screening that they used to do by talking to a sales rep
mm-hmm.
themselves. And that's very damaging to a traditional sales force mm-hmm. that use their personal persuasion skills and whatever to react and move the customer a certain way. So basically, the sales rep is getting into the sales cycle way down the road, being disqualified when they're probably the best fit often.
Right.
So they have to change. That's the biggest difference is, yes, people will buy. And I myself went in a bookstore, did some research in marketing actually years ago. And so, I went to the best Amazon and looked up all the marketing books. And I went to the bookstore and I said, Barnes & Noble, I said, do you have these books? And they go, yeah. And he says, well, I'm just buying from Amazon because they could see the printout, because I want to see the book.
Uh-huh.
So Amazon, the internet educated me so that when I went into that mm-hmm. retail channel, I had to perceive I want to look at these five books.
Right.
So it's not what people thought it would be.
It almost helps people research a little bit more and become more educated as a consumer, I feel. But there's nothing that can replace the personal contact and the one-on-one. Would you agree?
People buy from people, and people buy from people they like. Now, speaking of that, though, moving towards the blogging, and that's the big advantage of smaller mm-hmm. companies, because it puts – you talk about, people buying from people they like in person to person. Service is a real component. Big companies used to be able to outspend sloppy product, sloppy support.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a classic example is Dell Computer, and I've had many Dells, and they're good products. But they elevated to a very senior executive position, the person who's in charge of blogs, because they got very badly damaged because their customer support started being rumored about in the blog and was hurting mm-hmm. purchases.
Now, wow.
And so customer support has come to the forefront, which is why we sell a lot of customer support systems. But blogs are a great equalizer, so that, yes, you're going to if you do a good job, people will buy from you. But if you do a bad job, you'll never be talked to. there will be no sales effort. So it really puts the premise on customer support, customer satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. And that integrates well with the optimization of the whole website, because one bad blogging review can be one of the first things a person sees when they're ready to purchase, and that could kill the whole purchase.
That's exactly correct. Exactly correct.
So the blogging person at that organization, they have to make sure they're getting their information out there.
Well, yes. And, of course, you know, blogs are started by people who necessarily don't like you. And so you have to do an outstanding job and have enough people interested in supporting you that they'll come to your defense on the blogs that you don't monitor.
Right.
Right. How can people reach you?
Well, we have a website. The most interesting website is leadlife.com. Or firstwave.net. The firstwave.net is focused on the traditional CRM applications, and leadlife.com is a new separate company that is doing an outstanding job of focusing on marketing automation.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your message, and we hope that people will contact you to learn more about your company and the exciting things that you're doing. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
A nice little segue into our next two guests talking about service. Both of them have a background in the hospitality industry, but yet have taken a little bit different path in their careers as of late. Our next guest is Dr. Sally Samura. Thank you for being our guest here on the Atlanta Business Radio Show, and welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And I understand you did have some background in the hospitality industry, correct, in human resources?
Yes, I was head of human resources for Bass Hotels and Resorts back 8 years ago, actually.
Wow. And what took you to your current career?
Well, I have always been interested in doing, you know, the organizational dynamics aspect of leadership. And one of the key things that I was really thinking about is whenever there's a new strategy that comes in, you know, and the organization's looking at that, you know, what does the organization need to do to be ready to implement that new strategy? You know, who are the right people? Do they have the right organization structure? Do we have the right processes in place to really be effective? And so, you know, I was constantly dealing with that. And one of the fun things about the hospitality industry is, you know, there was always changes going on. There's a lot of, you know, flags are going up, flags are going down. There's a lot of mergers and acquisitions in that. And you really have to say kind of what's the approach we're going to take and how are we going to make these things happen and how are we going to bring these teams together. And I found I had such a passion and love to do that, you know, I thought, yeah, I want to do that. That's what I want to do full time. And so that's how I switched over and actually decided to get off the road because we were in 100 countries and growing very rapidly. And in doing that, you know, you're on the road all the time. And, of course, it's, you know, international travel. So with that, I said, you know, I want to manage my life a little bit differently. So I decided to, and I'd always wanted to have my own business. So, you know, kind of aligning all those things together, I said, I'm going to go off and do it. I'm going to start my own business. I'm going to do the things that are really I'm very passionate about and very good at.
So tell us about your business.
We are a consulting firm. We specialize in working with organizations and teams to help them be more effective and in alignment. And it's usually things that are like, again, a new strategy, or you've got an organization where you need to change some of the culture pieces. Maybe some of the senior leadership team is, you know, they're working in silos. They're not working well together, especially in a tough business economy. You know, you've got to really be working well together. And so what we do is we really come in and help work with the teams and get that alignment together, get them all working in the same direction, make sure you've got the right people and the right approach so that you can be successful in delivering your business strategy.
Are you seeing any challenges with this, you know, having multiple generations all working together now for the first time?
Oh, absolutely. People come at things from such different perspectives, and what they want out of their careers are very different. And, you know, if people have been around a really long time, they're like, well, when I was coming up, I had to do all these things, and why don't you want to do these things, and why aren't you willing to put in, you know, the hours and things like that? So there's a piece about kind of getting them to understand each other's perspectives differently and being open to that and recognizing the power of kind of that diversity of thinking and the approach. And by the way, the market's really changing, too, in terms of who you're marketing to, and the generations are different in terms of what they're looking for. So you've got to be, again, you got to know your business strategy and you got to know what target market you're going after and then make sure you've got the right range of people to really help you attract to that market and do well in that market.
What types of companies do you work with? Does it Do you have a sweet spot? Is there one industry that you gravitate towards?
No, actually, when you're dealing with teams and people, every industry, it doesn't matter. I mean, right. Every industry is different and unique and has their own language and approach to things. But frankly, I also say that every company is unique mm-hmm. and every group and team is unique. So you have to really come in and figure out what works for this group and what works appropriately with these dynamics that are going on and tailor your programs to fit what they need. So the industry doesn't matter, but we work with all kinds of companies. Assurance Solutions is a company that we work with here. Ernst & Young is a company we work with. It's a full range.
Are there any like common cultural problems that companies have that you see?
Probably the biggest cultural problem is, you know, I'm going to work on my own thing. So it's that silo mentality
right.
of I've got maybe a broad organization that has a lot of different divisions. And so they tailor, well, I'm going to let this division be successful. And the executive for that division wants their team to be successful. And they forget that they're really part of a bigger organization. And again, in tough times, when you're saying, what exactly am I going to invest in? I don't have a surplus of money. So what exactly am I going to go after for this year to really accomplish and invest in the business? What you have to do is really you have to look broader than mm-hmm. just each of your own groups. And oh, by the way, from a leadership perspective, you want talent to be moving throughout the organization. You want to be building that capability so that people can move around, get mm-hmm. exposure and experience so that if something happens in a particular, you've got major growth spurt or somebody leaves for some reason, you have people in place that you can kind of say, oh, you know what, you're going over to this other division. Mm-hmm. It's going to be good for your career, and also you're going to bring some different thinking and approach into that new organization. So it allows kind of a broader thing.
How do you manage like, I know I deal with a lot of small business people in here, and I see they're always taking risks. And in a lot of the bigger corporations, they get kind of penalized for taking risks if they fail. And then inherently, as in business, taking risks, you might fail. So how do you deal with that, like, from a senior level? Like, you want to encourage them to take chances and to kind of push the envelope, but they're also covering their butt, you know, in case things blow up and they don't want to be, you know, blamed for it.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point you're making, Lee, about a culture of innovation. It doesn't matter the size of the organization. It matters what senior leadership is driving as a message. So if they're saying, we really want innovation, we want you to be taking risk, then the fact that you actually took a risk, obviously that it's kind of a calculated risk, I would say. It's not like kind of totally out there, but really makes sense for what you're doing in your industry, but it's something that's stretching. That you're trying for, that might go, and it doesn't work as well. They say, well, what did we learn from this? And then take that and build right. that into the organization as opposed to, you know, bad you for having, you know, right. not been as
you're
successful
now,
as we
we're
wanted.
We're moving you to South Dakota, you know.
Yeah,
congratulations.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So there are organizations, I used to joke about them that, you know, they'd put people in the penalty box
right.
For a while. And I was like, and the value of that is what? I mean, you just invested a lot of money in these people.
Right.
They made a mistake.
Right.
Why aren't we learning from it? So I think the job of senior executives nowadays is to really build that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And because the market is changing so fast, they've got to be the ones that help drive in the organization that it's okay to take risks. Under what parameters? But they've got to define those parameters
right.
and really help people to understand the types of things and foster it. There's ways you can bring innovation into an organization. So if your organization is kind of just coming back with the same old answers all the time and you mm-hmm. need some innovation brought in, that's something that you need to start looking at senior leadership to say, what are the messages that you're giving?
Right.
What are you doing to get people to be more creative and open?
And that's what your group does. It helps them in that area?
We certainly do.
What would you say are the three qualities of a great leader? If you could just give us three qualities that across the board in the leaders and the team building that you've worked with, are there three common denominators?
Well, you know, it depends on what they're trying to build in that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would go to, you know, I want them to be strategic thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to be able to look external to the market and say, here's what the future is going to be and how do we position ourselves to that.
Right.
So I want an external view and a strategic view from a very senior leader. I want somebody who's got phenomenal communication skills. So they've got to have the ability, they've got to believe in what they're doing. and be really passionate about it, but they also have to be able to deliver that message to others. So it's about how do I make it real for you to do that. So there's a whole, you know, communication piece. And the third thing I think is critical is team building. Mm-hmm. They've got to have the ability to be a leader and to bring groups of people together to go after things and accomplish objectives. So if they can do that, you know, they can see the future, they can bring the teams together, they can communicate to help build that vision and that approach around it. That's really the top three, I would think.
In building leaders for the future in business, how do you see technology as fitting in there? I just look at my own kids and I see the texting and the emailing, and we've kind of gotten away from the personal communication skills. Do you find that when dealing with younger executives, or is that something that they're still really focusing on at universities?
Well, I'm not sure what the university, you know, at the bachelor level, what they're focusing on right now. But I would say that it's something that if you can't do both, mm-hmm. you're going to be in trouble.
Right.
Okay. So you've got to be able to use technology and use it smart.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly, people, as Richard was saying, people, you know, build from relationships. So they'll want to buy from a relationship perspective, and they also want to trust you as you're talking about bringing your team together and developing. So in order to do that, you need that face-to-face kind of connections that you're able to do with people well, and you've got to be able to articulate your message succinctly and appropriately. And you need both the written, but you definitely need the oral as well.
And you mentioned before the show that you're working in a lot of different countries, but yet you don't have to travel. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. I do a lot of video conferencing. I mean, that's basically the way to do it. Now, when you first meet with, start with a group, it's important to have that face-to-face connection. So I will fly over and meet with people. I'm going to Argentina. I was in Korea. You know, you go out and you kind of meet with people and you kind of get that face-to-face connection. They know who you are. You spend some time. You've had dinner with them, you know, all those kinds of things. And then after that, you don't have to be there every time you need a meeting. Now you can be doing the video conference and the teleconferences and things like that.
I heard of an organization that they do their meetings in Second Life. They created an island and then they all meet in Second Life.
How cool is that? That's above my technology capability, but I'm sure there's very innovative companies to be doing things like that. That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you so much for being our guest today. Do you have any final thoughts, or you want to let
your
people
website,
know how they can reach you?
Anything, events happening?
The Roswell Tree July 4th next year. They can reach us at traversaconsulting.com, and I'm Sally Jamara. And I would just say that it's really important that if you're going to work with people to help you in your organization and your team, that you're comfortable that they've got the experience and the capability to really understand your situation from not just a symptom perspective, but really some of the core issues that are going on to help you and really be focused on a long-term relationship with you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Next up, we have an author and speaker, Theo Gilbert Jamison. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Author of The 6 Principles of Service Excellence and also the CEO of Managing Partners of Performance Solutions by Design. I'm anxious, first of all, to hear a little bit about your book and about your background. Why don't we start with your background first? Where did you start?
Great. I started with the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company a great long, long time ago, right out of college. I was 23 years old, not sure what I wanted to do with my career, and stumbled upon a great organization that gave me over a period of 17 years an opportunity to really see what it's like to take care of the customer and to create loyal customers that are customers for life. So started as a secretary, moved my way up to the vice president of training and organizational effectiveness, where I was able to take the message of ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen, the credo of the Ritz-Carlton, all the great dynamics that make it a wonderful organization, and drive it internationally for the company.
So how long have you been out on your own?
My company, Performance Solutions by Design, will be 5 years old November 1st.
Wow. Yay. Congratulations. That's a big deal, 5 years. So what have you seen in 5 years? I mean, you started, I'm sure there's a little anxiety and fear, but 5 years, what have you seen change? How have you developed? Tell us about your book.
Well, the book was really to open up some of those secrets. When I work with the Ritz, my last couple of years was really, again, helping other organizations understand what are some of those dynamics. I decided to put that in a book, and not only looking at the Ritz and what they do to create a culture of service excellence, but other world-class organizations like Disney, Nordstrom's. You always hear people say, we want to be like Disney, we want to be like the Ritz-Carlton, we want to be like Nordstrom's. But we also wanted to look at GE and Toyota because of process improvement and quality and so on. So we looked at those organizations. We found that there were six things that they had in common that drove excellence. So the six principles of service excellence actually shares what those six things are. And what it does is takes any organization through a process to help them look at, you know, what is the culture of your organization? How do you work to align everyone around that? How do you create fully engaged employees in order to drive bottom line profits and so on? So that book took on that journey. And then just recently, I co-authored a book with my business colleague, Vivian Bright, and that's called The Leadership Book of Numbers. And that was based on, we run into so many young leaders that want to be like us. They want to, you know, just gain higher heights in their career. And what it is just simple tips, best practices on how to be the best that you can be and how to excel within your organization.
Why do you think there's so much poor customer service nowadays?
There is poor customer service because leaders don't do an excellent job or a good job of driving excellence. And you know, I speak to CEO groups across the board all around the world. They don't want to hear that, you know, that it starts at the top and that creating a culture of excellence is something that trickles down. As Sally was saying, it starts with leadership, their drive, their enthusiasm for customer service and satisfaction and loyalty, and that trickles down to every single employee. When I worked at the Ritz, you know, our CEO was very prominent in saying that we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen, and that everyone within the organization should be treated with dignity and respect. In the hotel scenario, whether you were a dishwasher, a housekeeper, or the CEO of the organization. So it has to trickle down with that mindset.
But it seems like every CEO, or if you read any of the annual reports, they always give lip service to that. It just seems like such a huge disconnect. I mean, every company knows what the Ritz-Carlton exists. Every company knows Nordstrom exists. They go in there, they see the experience, they feel the experience, and then they go back to their companies and they just purposely don't do it? I mean,
I think that they don't realize how to do it. So the six principles of service excellence really takes leaders through a journey. Where are our gaps? On a scale of 1 to 5 with 5 high, if you were to look at service today, what would our desired state of perfection look like? Mm-hmm. And where are we today? And what we find is that most organizations are somewhere around a 2 or a 3.
Well, that's the six generous.
That's generous. As a matter of fact, the previous CEO, who I consider a role model, and mentor, Horst Schulze, previous CEO for the Ritz-Carlton, would often say to us that we were the best of a lousy lot. On a scale of 1 to 5 with 5 high, he would even say we're a bloody 3.
Wow.
You know, but wow. Thank God the competition is a 1 or 2. And this is after winning 2 Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Awards,
right,
and
wow,
all these great accolades. So you have to be honest in looking at where are our gaps. And it takes more than just knowing, but now what are we going to do to close the gaps? And
right,
that's where the key, that's where it rests.
So in the six principles of service excellence, do you talk about the implementation of those?
Absolutely. And really, when you think about our organization, Performance Solutions by Design, that's what differentiates us from others. There are many world-class speakers that can go out, give a great razzmatazz speech, make everybody feel really great about service excellence. But then what happens after that? What we do after that is we go in, we help them to identify where their gaps are, and then look at, Richard was saying, every organization is different. Where are the gaps in your organization, and what do we need to do in order to close those gaps? It really is a customized approach.
That's great. And how can people reach you?
Performance Solutions by Design is our company, and we're on the internet. Website, of course, is psbydesign.com.
Do you have any seminars or speaking engagements coming up?
Once a month, actually, we offer a program at Emory University's Continuing Education Center, and
oh,
it's called the Six Principles of Service Excellence. So you can just go on their website to get information on when that date is coming up.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being a guest today. Any final thoughts to share with our listeners?
Just remember that creating a culture of service excellence is a journey. It's not a destination. Mm-hmm. And that along that journey, there'll be many bumps. But in the end, creating a lifetime customer is worth taking that path.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you all for being our guests today. Any final thoughts from you, Lee?
Do you want to do Margo?
Margo, you ready?
Ready or not?
I'm ready.
You know, I love when Margo sends me an email because it says Margo, and the go is a large G and a large O.
That's right.
So I always know that Margo is ready to go.
She's always ready to go.
She was relaxing without her headphones on. I just wasn't real sure. Margo Geller, welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. She's a seasoned entrepreneur, and she's also a coach. You know, a lot of the things we've talked about today have to do with sales and service, and that's Margo's specialty is coaching individuals and groups in that area. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Hi.
Now, Margo, why don't you talk a little bit about your new program, the E2E?
The E2E stands for Employee to Entrepreneur, and I developed that program to help the employee that is actually always dreamed about going out on their own and are feeling ready and have something specific in mind that they'd be excited to do. And since that's a really scary thing, especially when you've been an employee in the corporate world for 25, 30 years, and now you're going to give up that big paycheck. And so I developed this program where it's pretty innovative in the way I see it. And I am the primary person in the sense that I provide the personal support, helping them get their confidence up, manage their fears. And also, one of the things I'm really think I'm really sort of top of the line on is that I'm really big on relationship selection. So I also help them with networking, which is really building and nurturing the right relationships. But it's having the discipline to pick, to define the right relationship and then pick only those people. So, and then I have a team of what I call hard side professionals that help these clients with things like the accounting, the financial side, the organizational. So it's really a team approach, which makes it more fun.
So when you're dealing with somebody who was just, say they were just downsized, and now they're on their own, and they're deciding what they're going to do for the rest of their lives, you meet with them, and then in their head they might think, oh, I'm going to buy a franchise, and then what would happen at that point?
Well, again, we're getting back to client selection. What I tell, like, HR professionals is this person's being let off, and typically they will hook them up with an outplacement agency to find a job. And I want that HR person to say to them, you know, this might be a time that you want to go out on your own. And I say, stop, don't go, call Margo. And I will talk to them, and without even running any tests, I can ask them the questions and use my gut after all these years of interviewing potential entrepreneurs and then say to them, I think this is a good idea. And franchise versus really going out on your own are really two separate things.
Sure.
But I have a lot of franchise consultants that I
can point them
towards. Yeah, absolutely.
And then you might suggest, yeah, maybe you should get another job. That might be the right
exactly.
answer, too, right?
That's probably difficult to say. By the way, I think you need a job. Yeah. You need to stay an employee.
Yeah, I think I'm really good at that. I think people bond with me quickly, and I'm very loving. And I tell them on the front end, you know, I'm really going to tell you honestly, and I'm going to, you know, I think I'm, it's not about, I'm really interested in what's in your best interest. And it's always up to them in the end.
And what are some of the characteristics that would differentiate someone from an employee to someone who could go out on their own?
You know where I really find, where I really know they can be an entrepreneur is I have them describe to me their career path as an employee, and the entrepreneur has actually been an entrepreneur under the corporate umbrella. Mm-hmm. They have started a program. They have done something that's unique under that corporate umbrella. Also, the person in sales and marketing, those are the employees that I interview successful entrepreneurs informally all the time. I'm sort of a researcher constantly. I have my little things I'm researching. And 90% of the time they come out of sales and marketing, and they've been innovative under the corporate umbrella.
Interesting. That's interesting. Have you been innovative, Lee?
I try to be innovative.
I can imagine you being very innovative under the corporate umbrella.
I can't work in a corporate setting, I don't think.
Yeah, I understand that too. That's why I'm an entrepreneur.
Same here.
Margo, how can people reach you?
They can go to my website, Margo at margogeller.com, or preferable, they just can call me at 404-321-0609.
Wonderful. And thank you for being on the show today. And we really appreciate all of our guests. Lee, any final thoughts?
Man, full house, a lot of action today.
Lots of action. Until next week, thank you for listening and have a wonderful week.